Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. We call this the Dr. Greg Gyka Show because from the University of Kentucky, professor of neurology, director of the clinical core of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, and also affiliated with the Sanders Brown Center on Aging, we welcome Dr. Greg Gyka. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thanks for having me, Tony.
And my co-medical hosts, Shelley Irving and Rick Phillips, they are on sabbatical until someone learns how to manage silly string in the studio. I think we need to know who's in charge here. I'll say no more about that. Our website to listen to our show, WMKY.org. You can look at the tab there for local programming, and there you will find our past shows in all their glory. Our research is on HM Radio Show on Facebook. You can leave comments. You can like the stuff we have. You may look. We just posted, and this was courtesy of Shelley Irving, the world's largest Nerf gun, and shoots basically toilet plungers. It's a pretty neat video. Take a look at that. It has nothing to do with health, but we're sorry. Sometimes we get off course. We're coming to you from high atop the third floor of the McVeigh Building. The city of Lexington spread out like a sparkling jewel before us, a blistery, cold winter's day, and Dr. Gyka is here to talk to us, and we're welcome about that. Thanks to our listeners of True Talk Internet Radio, our sponsor for today's show, the Disease of the Month Club, this month's disease, top 10 fun facts about Alzheimer's disease. And I'm going to go with number one and two, Greg, because I wanted to spend some time on that. Number one, Alzheimer's disease first identified more than 100 years ago in 1906. Dr. Alois Alzheimer noted changes in brain tissue of a woman who died after an unusual mental illness. After he died, he examined her brain. There were abnormal clumps, which are now called amyloid plaques, and tangled bunches of fibers, bundles of fibers, called neurofibrillary tangles. And these, to this day, in fact, are the pathological changes we associate with Alzheimer's disease in the brain. Now, fun fact number two, and this is where we may spend some time, these two types of abnormal lesions, they still clog the brains of most individuals we diagnose with Alzheimer's disease. The plaques, we call them beta amyloid plaques, sticky clumps of protein fragments, and the tangles are twisted fibers composed of something called tau protein. Now, Greg, I know there has been a huge debate among the neurologic, among the Alzheimer community about whether these things accompany Alzheimer's disease, whether they cause it, and whether or not you can go after either the beta amyloid plaques or the tau protein to try to treat Alzheimer's disease. Can you catch us up on where we are with the causes of Alzheimer's disease?
Yeah, so I think you're exactly correct, Tony. And in 1906, we have the first description of those pathologic hallmarks, those plaques and tangles, as we call them. And really, it's taken a tremendous amount of time. There was about an 80-year lapse before we began to discover what they were actually made of. Now we know that the plaques, as you mentioned, are made up of amyloid, beta amyloid. And those that feel that beta amyloid may be responsible for Alzheimer's disease are frequently referred to as the Baptists of the religious discussion here. The tangles then in 1986 were found to be comprised of this protein tau. And those that follow the tau theory of what causes Alzheimer's are known as the Taoists. So we have this battle between the Baptists and the Taoists. And really, we've been trying to tease that out over the last 20, 30 years now. I think we have this pretty well parsed out currently. We know that there are some rare genetic forms of Alzheimer's disease. As a matter of fact, the first Alzheimer patient was shown just 2 years ago to have a mutation that increased the production of amyloid. And that mutation, while incredibly rare in the world, if you have that increase in amyloid, inescapably, you will develop Alzheimer's. So that really places amyloid at the crux. We do know, however, that it's the neurofibrillary tangles that are related to the memory problem most directly. So those tangles injuring nerve cells cause the nerve cells to die, and that's directly responsible for the memory problems. Tying how the amyloid plaques actually create the neurofibrillary tangles or promote their spread has been the work really of the last decade. And we've developed ways, Tony, where unlike 10 years ago, where we could only detect those plaques and tangles at autopsy or with a biopsy of the brain in the pathology suite, we now can use specific forms of PET scanning to see the plaques and tangles. And we know in living human beings that those plaques begin 15 to 20 years before the onset of memory problems. About 5 years before the onset of memory problems, 5 to 10, we start to see the tangles appear. About 5 years again before the memory problems, we start to see the brain shrink, and that's a reflection of that loss of nerve cells that only after many years, perhaps even 2 decades of this pathology building in the brain, does one start to develop memory problems.
Now, you mentioned that. Now, I know, because I have some friends that are involved in some of your research studies, that sometimes on the scans you will see the beta amyloid, and yet people will not go on, it appears, to develop Alzheimer's disease. But the tau, once you see the tau proteins, then it's pretty much inevitable. Is that the way it is, or could you have both of those on a scan and still not develop Alzheimer's?
You know, that is a great question. So when we're talking about these scans, what we're really talking about are special PET scans that have been developed. Many people ask me your standard CAT scans and MRIs, if I can see the plaques and tangles on them. We can't on those scans, but we certainly do on these specialized scans. We simply have not had that technology for long enough, I think, to really answer those questions definitively. We know that many folks who never develop memory problems may pass away and have plaques in the brain, and yet they never really had Alzheimer's because they never really had a memory problem. And likewise, for tangles, one can pass away with tangles and not have a problem. So really, it's going to take some time. Given that we have a 20-year course and we've only had these tools for about 10 years now, it's going to take us at least another 10 to really definitively know whether or not in some of us there could be a natural halting or stopping of the disease process where the plaques start to build but then just hold. We do know, however, with the tangles over the last several years that, indeed, once they start spreading across the brain, they actually are passed from nerve cell to nerve cell. So this isn't an infection. Alzheimer's is not contagious, but it spreads through a person's brain, nerve cell to nerve cell. And trying to stop that process is really, really important. Understanding how it spreads is the first clue towards treatments that may stop that progression.
So that's our sponsor, Disease of the Month Club. This month's disease, in fact, is surprisingly Alzheimer's disease. Now, we went in deep, and we went in fast, mm-hmm. Because this is one of the areas that I'm fascinated with, is trying to get at the actual cause, because obviously that's how you start developing really effective therapies. But we go back for a minute, and always in this segment when we've got a guest, we talk about how you became interested in neurology, how you became interested in Alzheimer's disease, and how you got to Kentucky. Just very briefly, for our radio fans not familiar with Dr. Jaika, you did a medical degree from Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx, and also a PhD from the same institution, correct?
That's correct.
And then on to the Mayo Clinic for a residency in neurology and also a fellowship in behavioral neurology. Now, as I recall from last time we talked, young Greg Jaika, brilliant neurologist, the world at his feet, saw, in fact, an opening here in Kentucky to work with Dr. Marksberry, one of the absolute greats in understanding many aspects of aging, and came here. Can you pick it up from there? I'm particularly interested in why you got interested in Alzheimer's disease and other forms of cognitive impairment, and then what your practice here is like now.
So that's great. Thanks, Tony. And so, yeah, it's been a winding trip from somebody who grew up in the small state of Connecticut. I think that's about the size of Fayette County anyway. And then moved to New York City. It really, at that time, I had started some early research in the area of Parkinson's. But really, when I hit medical school and was pursuing my PhD, I really looked at things, and I looked at what was most important to me about myself, and it really was my memory and thinking. It was my intellectual abilities that I was most in fear of losing, and one thinks about that at such a young age, but you take a few of those medical school tests, and I know you've been through it, Tony, and one starts to doubt their own intelligence at times. So really, I thought that Alzheimer's was such a big mystery that I began researching it in real earnest, and from there, my clinical interest just developed. You know, one would think being at the Mayo Clinic, it's such a wonderful institution, and Mayo indeed has one of the best Alzheimer's disease research and clinical care centers in the world. But what most people don't realize, even people here in Kentucky, is that the Alzheimer's Center at the University of Kentucky is on exactly the same par. And not only that, we were established years before the Mayo Clinic Alzheimer's Disease Center was established. So we have a much longer and richer history of creating and making these discoveries that are bringing us closer to the point of finding new medicines, a potential cure for the disease. Now, here in Lexington, and it's one of the things that I always marvel about at the university, is not only do we have a relatively, what I consider after living in New York, small town living environment, a home right in the city with a nice yard, and that's just wonderful for my family, but that rich decades of data that's been collected and the Kentucky people that are so generous to engage in the research that we're doing over time, to donate their brains for scientific discovery when they pass away, to give blood donations, spinal fluid in some instances, has given us the ability to really make remarkable discoveries. It is like a playground for a scientist, and the questions have never been greater. The last great frontier in medicine frequently is referred to as the brain and our consciousness and how this all works together. And unlocking those mysteries is really like an episode of Star Trek to me.
Star Trek playground. I understand. I mean, you have to understand and listen sympathetically. Dr. Jaika's real passion is for this type of research. But rarely among researchers do you find a person who is also a top-notch clinician. And, Greg, I know I've worked with you some using your telemedicine clinic to extend your ability to help people with Alzheimer's disease all over the state.
That's right. You know, I think that's really important and something that I strive to do here at the university as well. We have many people that research, but frequently they're distanced from the people with the diseases that they may be working on. And I think that's a big mistake. I think that we're here to help people directly. And so that clinical component of what I do, which is, you know, in an average working day, I'm seeing patients about 8 hours a day. My research really is done after hours as part of those clinical encounters. That is tremendously rewarding, and the need is great. There are only a handful of behavioral neurologists, dementia specialists in the state of Kentucky. And, of course, we need many, many more. There are only a handful in the nation. And right now, there is a huge need. If we have any young medical students or residents listening to us out there, I will tell you this is a field where you can pretty much pick your future because we are so in need of folks to help. So you're right, Tony. I see folks here regularly, and after moving to Kentucky, I mean, this is a really big state. And again, you know, I go back to my roots in Connecticut, which you can drive across in about 40 minutes from north to south. to here in Kentucky, where one can drive, you know, 4 hours to Pikeville to the east and 4 or 5 hours to Paducah or Murray Calloway on the other side. So we have a really big state, and I cannot be everywhere in the state, and yet there are people out there with need. And let me tell you, if you have a family member or a friend with memory and thinking problems, in the car and driving them 5 hours each way to come and see me is just an obstacle. And so many people won't receive that care. With telemedicine, as you know, we can beam right into the local medical facility and in the future potentially right into the home directly to provide that kind of subspecialty care that you just can't find in many local areas here.
We're going to let you think on that for a moment and take a break. We'll be back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio. I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. With me from the University of Kentucky, Dr. Gregory Jaika, a professor of neurology, director of the clinical core of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, and also affiliated with the Sanders Brown Center on Aging. Welcome back, Greg.
Thanks, Tony.
Our sponsor for the second time, the Disease of the Month Club. This month's disease, Alzheimer's disease. Now, we talked, these were the things that really concerned me last time about the potential cause of Alzheimer's disease. Let me remind you of those, and we'll give you a couple of other fun facts about this condition. First of all, fun fact number one, identified in 1906 by Dr. Alois Alzheimer, who not only took care of a patient with Alzheimer's disease, but also was able to dissect that patient's brain after death and found many of the features that we are still working on to this day. Fun fact number two, we talked about this. There are two pathologic changes in the brain, the beta amyloid plaques, the tau protein, fibrillary tangles, that are often accompanying Alzheimer's disease. They are, as Greg pointed out last time, we are not certain that there are some people who have these and do not appear to have any memory problems whatsoever, but people who have Alzheimer's disease typically have these changes. Fun fact number three, it's the sixth leading cause of death in Kentucky. We in Kentucky have an estimated 69,000 people with Alzheimer's disease. Over 1,400 people died back in 2013 with Alzheimer's disease. Fun fact number four, according to the U.S. Alzheimer's Association, 1 in 8 people age 65 and older, and nearly half of people over age 85, and this is a condition that is more prevalent as you get older, have Alzheimer's disease. Fun fact number five, age is the primary risk factor. The number of cases of Alzheimer's disease doubles every 5 years in people over age 65. And then fun fact number six, because I want to follow that immediately, it is unusual to develop Alzheimer's disease before age 60, but 4% of those with Alzheimer's disease, perhaps up to 500,000 people, are under age 65. So this is a disease of older people, but not exclusively a disease of older people. Greg, on the spectrum here, what's the youngest that you've seen who has Alzheimer's disease? And does it have kind of a separate course and a separate process for younger people, or is it a similar condition regardless of age?
Those are great questions, Tony. You know, and I'll bring you back to Alzheimer himself in the original case that he described in 1906, known as August D. And August was 51 years old when she died. Her onset of disease was in her mid-40s. She had a very aggressive genetic form of disease. Now, we do see frequently, we see folks in their 40s. My youngest patient to date was 38 when the onset of memory symptoms came about, much younger than I am currently, and that's frightening. A lot of that is related to these very rare genetics. So most of us out there are worried about early onset Alzheimer's disease, or really looking at it in our mid to late 50s, early 60s. We consider that still any onset before the age of 65 as an early onset case. And again, as you mentioned, it does keep building and increasing in frequency every added year of life.
That's our sponsor, the Disease of the Month Club, this month's disease, Alzheimer's disease, and we will continue with our top 10 fun facts about Alzheimer's disease in our next fractional portion. Now, when we left last segment, we were talking about your telemedicine clinic. I want to come back just briefly and mention Greg, first of all, sees patients in Lexington. Secondly, how many different remote sites do you have now in your telemedicine clinic?
So we have about 12 sites scattered across Kentucky in various regions from Moorhead and the St. Clair Medical Center there, out to Harlan at the ARH, to Western Baptist in Paducah, and many points in between, really giving us an opportunity to be very close to wherever you may be right now listening to the show.
And that gives you an opportunity then to schedule an appointment with a leading authority in Alzheimer's disease and yet keep your loved one in your own community. It's a wonderful service. And the other thing I want to add, the devotion that that Greg has, there is an Alzheimer's support group that you also run through this telemedicine group that comprises local groups, but also a statewide call-in session where you answer questions coming from all over the state.
That's absolutely correct. And I think, Tony, it's very much like your radio show, reaching out to help people at the grassroots level, real people living in real communities. And if you have a loved one with a disease like Alzheimer's or Alzheimer's itself, you know how difficult this can be. You need education. You need a support network to find the resources that are going to help you make this manageable and really provide the best quality of life, not just for your loved one with Alzheimer's, but for you yourself as a caregiver. So really, really important. That's something we've been providing free of charge and communities, and we're working right now with technology to allow people to link in individually from their homes if they're not able to make it out to a local medical center. So we see this as an expanding resource, Tony.
So again, research on Alzheimer's disease, but also research on care. When you think about it, if you have a nationally recognized expert who can take care of your loved one in your own community, then take advantage of national resources and his knowledge of the situation in Lexington, the research that he's doing, but also you combine that with a local support group that can tell you where you could get daycare for an elderly person, where you could get assistance with activities of living and things like that. This is really, hopefully, the way medical care will evolve, that combination of national expertise and local knowledge. And I've observed this admiringly as you've done this in Moorhead, and I can tell you it is a real resource for the community to have one of these telemedicine clinics. You can kind of see where medicine would go, and so I'm very excited about that. That's our sponsor. No, that's not our sponsor. That's just finishing up from. I want to move forward, though, as well. There have been several press reports, and this was November 21st, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Internal Medicine Journal, came out of the University of Michigan. They were looking at their health and retirement study, and they looked at how many people had Alzheimer's disease among their retirees. 10,000 surveys and change, adults over age 65 years. They looked at about 2,000 in the year 2000 and in the year 2012. And in 2000, the prevalence of dementia was 11.6% in these surveys. And it dropped to 8.8% in 2012. Now, that is a really large drop, and this is a fairly large number of surveys. We've seen this reported in European countries as well and other places around the world. It appears, first of all, I want to ask you, do you think that it actually is dropping? And then secondly, what do you think is going on?
You know, this is great. Now, I'd like to believe that it'll just keep dropping every year and eventually the prevalence will be zero. That is a prayer for all of us out there. But I think that's wishful thinking, Tony. Nonetheless, we can see this trend. And as you mentioned, we're seeing this worldwide. Now, I want to just clarify that while we're seeing the relative percentage of the population decreasing in Alzheimer's because of the increased size of that aging population with baby boomers and the like, the absolute number of Alzheimer's patients is still skyrocketing. And we really think it's going to hit a maximum around 2050 if we don't do something quickly. But it is intriguing that we actually see the relative percentage in the population reducing. Now, I think, you know, the data from Minnesota showing a 3 percentage point drop is questionable as to whether or not there may have been some other confounds within the context of that study. But overall, we are seeing maybe even up to a 2% relative population drop. We think that that has to do with improved medical care and improved lifestyle factors that reduce Alzheimer's risk. So, you know, we can all go back to World War II when everybody smoked. We gave lucky strikes and killed our own soldiers to nowadays where we all recognize that this is a problem, that we all need to wear our Fitbit, be a little more active, be a little more healthy.
You know, and there has been that association all along, and I think this really leads very well into the next section I want to talk about, between conditions that affect your circulation and Alzheimer's disease. As a matter of fact, one of the thoughts is that we are much better at controlling high blood pressure than we were a decade ago, and that may be responsible for this. You mentioned smoking, other risk factors for circulation problems, things like cholesterol and so forth. Do you think we will be able to reduce significantly Alzheimer's disease by managing these risk factors?
You know, I think that we can. We've seen this work with heart disease. We've seen this work with certain cancers that have environmental risks, that people that know that they're at risk for a particular disease will pay attention to these risk factors and will work to try to reduce their risk. So increasing that knowledge, Tony, of what some of these risk factors are really will help people identify their personal targets in their life to try to prevent or avoid Alzheimer's for themselves and or their loved ones. And if we could impact and slow the development of Alzheimer's by just a year, we would save 500,000 people nationally from the disease. If we could slow the disease just through lifestyle changes by 5 years, we would cut the prevalence of Alzheimer's more than in half. And that may be some of what we're seeing in these population studies.
You know, there is the potential then we have some modifiable risk factors, things like high blood pressure, cholesterol, the things that you are risk factors for heart disease and stroke anyway. We talk some about the genetics. I think tough to do that on a radio show. But when you look at family history in general, the information I have says that if you have a first degree family relative, that is mother, father, sister, brother, had Alzheimer's disease or a form of dementia, you've got about a 10 to 30% increase in your risk. Now, that does not mean you got a 30% risk, but it means that your risk is increased by up to a third. If you have two or more affected siblings with Alzheimer's disease, your risk goes up 3 times the risk of the general population. I guess in order to interpret that, what's the risk in the general population?
So, well, your risk is actually quite high, you know, and you stated this before, Tony, that if each one of us lives to be the age of 85, one out of every two of us, like a coin flip, is going to have Alzheimer's until we can actually change and stop and prevent this disease. So that risk is going to be dependent really on what age you are, as well as other contributing factors like this familial risk that you mentioned. You know, it's interesting, Tony, and not to dwell on genetics, but there actually is a rare family in Iceland that was found a few years ago that has a genetic mutation that totally prevents Alzheimer's disease. This family cannot get Alzheimer's disease. They live to be 110, 120, sharp as can be. And so we know that family risks can also be partnered or mirrored by family protective factors. So hopefully your loved ones out there that are 85 are doing well, are staying sharp as ever. That may be conferring some benefit to you as well. So give them a big hug and kiss when you see them next.
Other risk factors, type 2 diabetes and obesity, associated with about a 1.5 time increased risk. Lifestyle and activity, physically active individuals, lower incidence. What do you think is happening there?
You know, what we've looked at this in several different ways, and, you know, it's just beginning really to be studied in people on a broad sense. We are engaged currently in a study of people with very mild memory problems where we're giving them a membership to the local Y and giving them personal trainers and having them exercise 4 times a week. And beginning to investigate this in great detail. But we do know from animal studies and from retrospective or questionnaires of people, how much do you exercise, that we can relate and see these risks. In the animal models, we can begin to tease this out. When we exercise, there is improved blood flow and oxygen delivery to the brain, and that can be extremely beneficial. One of the other things that we know is going on is that as we exercise, the muscles in the liver send a signal that causes the body to produce what we know as BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or, as I like to call it, miracle grow for the brain. So we think that we can't grow new nerve cells, but actually we do. We do throughout life, and we can increase that several fold by exercising, even as little as 20 minutes of brisk walking a day. That BDNF causes new nerve cells to grow directly in the memory areas that are most susceptible to Alzheimer's disease. So a little bit of time out there walking in the fresh air, but bundle up today. It can make a world of difference in terms of your risk for Alzheimer's.
What's the story with brain trauma and Alzheimer's?
You know, this is a tough one, Tony, because we think about brain trauma as a risk, and I don't think we pay enough attention to it before the brain trauma happens. But we do indeed know that significant brain injury, that may be a single injury, can have a tremendous influence on the development of Alzheimer's. We also know that even repetitive light hits to the head, like a soccer player who bounces the ball off their head, or football players who receive minor hits but not even a real concussion. Over time, those cumulative hits predispose not just to Alzheimer's, Tony, but as we've seen with Muhammad Ali, to Parkinson's disease and what now is known as the NFL player's disease, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which really has been described just over the last few years. So this head injury is a risk that we have to be worried about. And I think it's important, you know, that we make sure that if we're out there bicycling, that we're wearing a helmet. If our grandchildren are out there, get them a helmet. Get them a fancy one that they're proud to wear. But the time to think about traumatic brain injury is not picking up the pieces after the fact. It's really being proactive. And the same holds true for many of these other risk factors, Tony.
A couple of my sources mentioned on medications, sleeping pills seem to have some association, but they argue about whether that's because people who have cognitive problems are, in fact, having difficulty sleeping early on or whether the pills cause damage. What's your thinking?
You know, that is a great question. We don't fully have the answer to it, but we do know that when you sleep at night, this is a prime time for your brain to try to clean amyloid out of it rather than have it accumulate as plaque. So we know that this process is very active at night. And so sleeping can be extremely beneficial for lowering the amount of amyloid that you may make. On the other hand, we also know that many different medicines that alter the way the brain functions, and sleeping aids are just one of them, they help alter the brain so that we sleep better, can actually change the way nerve cells talk with one another. And by dampening that process, we do know, at least in animal experiments and experiments in the laboratory, we know that that can lead to less healthy nerve cells that are going to be much more vulnerable to diseases like Alzheimer's. So I think there's probably a pinch of truth in both of those thoughts, Tony.
Also, one of my least favorite drugs, the bladder control drugs, and the sleepy antihistamines, things like Benadryl, have been implicated.
And that's right. You know, and this is a big problem. There is a list out there, and your pharmacist can help you with this if you're concerned about your own medications. The list is called the Beers List, and that is not a list or a menu that you get at your local pub, but it is spelled B-E-E-R-S. And the Beers List is a list of medicines you should try to avoid as you age to lessen the impact on your memory and thinking. And indeed, over-the-counter sleep aids and many of the current bladder agents are in that group where we try to avoid them. There are frequently much better, safer replacements. Again, the place to start, I think, is with your pharmacist in terms of reviewing your medication list, and then an open and frank discussion with your doctor could do you a world of good.
We have no rational explanations for anything in health matters, so we're going to take a break and come back with our third and final fractional portion.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio. I'm Dr. Tony Weaver, and with us from the University of Kentucky is Dr. Greg Jaika. He's a professor of neurology there, also the director of the clinical core of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, Sanders Brown Center on Aging, and an expert clinician on matters of dementia, cognitive impairment, and Alzheimer's disease. The sponsor of our show for the last time, the Disease of the Month Club. This month's disease is Alzheimer's disease, and we have our top 10 fun facts, which we will go through rather rapidly. First of all, discovered in 1906 by Dr. Alois Alzheimer. Secondly, caused apparent or associated, I'll put it that way, with two significant brain lesion, one beta amyloid plaques, two tau protein tangles. And these two things seem to be present in many people with Alzheimer's disease, if not all of them. However, as Greg pointed out, just because you see those on a PET scan does not indicate that Alzheimer's disease is inevitable. Fun fact number three, sixth leading cause of death in the state of Kentucky, over 1,400 deaths per year from Alzheimer's disease. Number four, one in eight people age 65 and older have it, and as we talked about, nearly one in two people over age 85 have it. If it runs in your family and you make it to age 85, odds are fairly high for many people. Age is the primary risk factor. The number of cases doubles every 5 years in people over age 65. Number six, it's exceptional to occur for it to occur before age 60. But again, Greg has seen cases down to late 30s, unfortunately. Fun fact number seven now, one in three seniors. This is not a very fun fact. One in three seniors dies with Alzheimer's disease or another type of dementia. And again, Greg, we've got to talk about there are so many other forms other than Alzheimer's disease. And when because of the need for knowledge about Alzheimer's disease, well, it seems like we never get to those. So we'll get you back on the show for that. Number eight, almost two-thirds of Americans with Alzheimer's are women. Now, I assume because women tend to be less stupid than men and live longer than men is the primary factor. Is there something else that seems to predispose women?
You know, we're not entirely sure. A lot of it has to do with the fact that women live longer than men, but there also is a lot of intriguing evidence that hormonal status and estrogen may play a protective role. And so that lifetime of that estrogen exposure that men are frequently devoid of, but that women are enjoying throughout their lives, may indeed confer a late life resistance.
Number nine, people with the disease survive on average half as long as those without it. Number 10 in 2015, and we talked about this with a support group, a quarter of a million caregivers, estimated 300 million hours of unpaid care. Again, this is a condition that really saps the resources of families as well as the patient themselves. That is our sponsor, the Disease of the Month Club, this month's disease, not surprisingly, Alzheimer's disease. Now, we've talked about risk factors, the things that you can modify, things that you can't modify, and somewhat about how they affect people. And Greg and I were talking during the break how nice it would be to just pull a gene out of our pocket that would make us absolutely resistant to Alzheimer's disease. It may at some point in the future be possible to do that. There will be many questions surrounding it, I'm sure, but I would at least have a look if someone offered me that. But let's talk some about diagnosis now. We talked about the PET scanning. These things come in the literature all the time. There's a sense of smell, a loss of sense of smell. It's a great diagnostic test. There are great diagnostic, simple blood tests, all sorts of tests that will absolutely tell you. And yet, for some reason, Greg, you still examine people and talk to them despite the plethora of absolutely diagnostic tests out there. So can you shed some light on how you diagnose Alzheimer's disease and some of these tests that we hear about?
So I think that that's important, Tony. You know, frequently these tests are really kind of blown out of proportion by the media. They're exciting new discoveries, things that need to be followed up on. As of yet, we do not have a blood test. As of yet, we do not have a sniff test that is specific for Alzheimer's disease. So we really are left with conventional clinical diagnosis for the most part. These PET scans that we talked about, the ones for amyloid plaques, are FDA approved, but cost about $5,000 to $6,000. Your insurance isn't going to pay for those in the majority of cases, so it's not practical. The tau PET scans are not even approved by the FDA yet, still remain in the realm of research. So standard clinical practice really requires you, and I hope this never changes, Tony, it requires you sitting and talking with the patient and family member, actually examining them, looking for early memory problems. And then the important things that we need to do are really spelled out like a cookbook, Tony. This is the American Academy of Neurology practice parameter, not just to determine if there is a problem or not, but also to begin to enable us to look at, is this Alzheimer's or could this be related to something else? That recipe includes a picture of the brain. Everybody needs a CT or an MRI scan if they're coming down with a memory problem. It requires some blood work to look at thyroid, to look at certain vitamin levels, to make sure that there's not another medical reason why the memory and thinking is down. In that imaging and in that workup, we 95% of the time can be highly accurate with a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. That workup is entirely covered by every insurance plan out there, including Medicare and Medicaid.
You know, and that's it's an important point. We look with the evaluation, you're actually looking for other potential causes that may be treatable and partially or completely reversible. So the CAT scan, the CT scan, the MRI scan, looking for other conditions that might lead to memory loss and mimic Alzheimer's disease. But as you pointed out, you will not see Alzheimer's disease necessarily on those scans, but you can rule out other things. I will tell you, the reason I know about Greg's telemedicine clinic office was at one time next to the St. Clair site for your telemedicine clinic. And I would be working in my office trying to get something done, and Greg has this booming voice. And so he would, and I'll try to imitate you, Greg, he would come on and say, "Now, Mrs. Smith, I want you to remember these three objects." And you would name three objects, and I could not help myself. I would try to remember those three objects. So I told my staff I was getting a dementia test pretty much on a weekly basis there for about a year. And I will tell you, most of the time I could come up with at least two of the three objects, and I felt really comfortable about myself. But it does, one of the things I learned from you is that there is that change over time, that a change is something that is very, very important. If you are a forgetful person, you may be a forgetful person. But if that level of forgetfulness changes, that is something that may push you toward getting an evaluation.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. You know, Alzheimer's is not a lifelong problem. You're not born with it like freckles and carry that throughout life. It's something that's going to change and evolve. So really, we are not looking for the terminal key loser, wallet forgetter. We're looking for somebody who's developing new problems with memory and thinking.
And what is it about the problems usually occur with acquiring new memories? People with even significant Alzheimer's disease can remember incidents in their childhood vividly. As a matter of fact, in many cases, that's the memories that they have of today. Is that a separate area of the brain, or why does it affect only the or preferentially affect the recent memory?
Yeah, so that really is the creation. Alzheimer's affects the creation of new memories. And so it is fascinating, Tony, as you point out. Frequently, we even see patients in the early stages of Alzheimer's where their long-term memories, their memories of childhood, early adulthood, become even stronger. And that often is a quandary for the family. Well, they can't have Alzheimer's. They can remember our wedding day in 1941 like it was yesterday, far better than I can. And it's not that long-term memory. Eventually, as the disease spreads, those other areas of the brain involved in long-term memories will become impaired as well. But really, it's that early short-term memory, that repeating, asking the same question again, telling you the same story over and over again. This is a problem.
Now, again, according to the National Institute on Aging and Alzheimer's Association, you're looking at an impaired ability to acquire and remember new information, impaired reasoning and handling of complex tasks, impaired visual-spatial abilities. And you still have your patients draw the clock face to see if they can handle the visual-spatial stuff.
Absolutely. Many other things as well. Now, if you've never been an artist, not to worry. We take that into account.
But you should be able to draw a circle and put some hands on it. Impaired language functions and changes in personality. These are the type of things that you see. And these are the things that would drive you then to actually have you or someone you love evaluated for Alzheimer's disease. And as Greg mentioned, there are no shortcuts. There is no simple blood or imaging test. And you can't get this through a mail-in or through, so far anyway, through any iPhone app. You pretty much need to see somebody and talk to that person if those things change. When you make the diagnosis, is this something that you say, okay, I think after we've looked at all this, this is really has to be this? How certain are you in making the diagnosis after you've finished your clinical evaluation?
So, again, in about 95% of cases, I'm definitive. And the work that we do with folks that donate their brain for scientific research after they pass away, that undergo an autopsy, really proves that point. There are some cases where it may be unusual or complex, and in those cases, sometimes we will waffle, and I will have to talk with families and tell them at times, I'm not 100% sure which of the degenerative diseases we're dealing with, but we're dealing with one of them, something like Alzheimer's.
Now we're going to move to our rapid response round because I want to talk some about treatment and we are rapidly running out of time. So, Greg, I'm going to just spit out some medicines to you that have been either used to perhaps alter the course or to treat the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, and I just want to get your thoughts on them. First one, obviously, we call them cholinesterase inhibitors, brand names Aricept, Exelon, Razadyne. Tell us about those drugs.
This is a good stuff for the brain, Tony. Not really changing the brain, but allowing the brain to function as it would normally when you were younger. Some side effects, stomach upset in about 1 out of 10 people, but 9 out of 10 just feel sharper on it.
And this, you said, changes function but does not alter the course. I have trouble with that. I mean, if you change function, it seems like you do alter the course.
You alter the course clinically. So that is correct, Tony. You keep people doing better for longer. What you don't change are the plaques and the tangles in the brain. They're continuing to destroy nerve cells over time, and eventually the disease itself overcomes the effects of these medicines.
Memantine, brand name Namenda.
Another good one. As a matter of fact, we use the memantine in conjunction with a cholinesterase inhibitor. It works to tune up a different brain chemical. And as I always tell people, it's kind of like tuning up the car. You don't just change the oil. You got to do the plugs and the air filter too. So this combination of medicines is the gold standard, state-of-the-art, current treatment for the clinical symptoms of Alzheimer's. Again, Tony, the memantine, like the cholinesterase inhibitors, it's not going to change those plaques and tangles. It's not going to stop the disease, but it is going to keep people doing better for longer.
Vitamin E.
Vitamin E has had a back and forth course over time. I do think it's important to recognize that many of the vitamins that are out there for the brain are not always without risk. So before you start a supplement, you really should talk with your doctor. Vitamin E can interfere with some of the medicines that are used to thin the blood. prevention of stroke and heart attack. These are important, may interfere with different cancer medications and the like. With that being said, if you do not have a contraindication or a risk in taking vitamin E, the data shows it may be mildly protective of the disease itself.
Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, these are things like Motrin and Aleve.
So, you know, the final word is not out on these. We've done several large studies. We've always failed to demonstrate a positive benefit. But the thought process currently is that different people may respond differently to these medications. We're trying right now, the state-of-the-art research is trying to figure out which patients might respond to NSAIDs or won't respond to those medicines so that we can begin to target medicine for the individual person.
Statins, the cholesterol-lowering drugs.
So statins, again, with a checkered past, some data suggesting that they might be helpful for the prevention of Alzheimer's, and yet other studies suggesting that they may actually be responsible for memory problems. My general take is you should not be placed on or stop a statin because of concerns of influence on Alzheimer's or your memory.
Finally, fish oil, omega-3 fatty acids.
I'm a big believer here, Tony. The data, again, can go back and forth, but the omega-3 fatty acids are critical building blocks for the brain. We do know that in those without genetic risk for Alzheimer's, these may play a significant role in slowing progression of disease. In those with normal age-related memory changes, we know that these medicines may these supplements may help as well.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Greg Jaika, professor of neurology at University of Kentucky, John Namagi, WKY operations manager, Morehead State Public Radio producer Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song. And to you, our loyal radio fans, remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire, WMKY.org, HM Radio Show. Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for our exciting series on the health benefits of procrastination on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.